Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 1942, written by the mastermind behind it all, Colonel Mansubu Suji. And we've just read about how the Japanese took a Australian fort on the coast by invading it through the jungle. And this next title is Deep Emotion in Johor Bahru. Johor Bahru is the actual, it's like the twin city of Singapore. It's the Malaysian side of Singapore, so that's pretty amazing. And it's a pretty depressing read. We're up to page 171. We're more than halfway through. Now let's read. Following the seizure of Labis by Singura Brigade, the commander of the 5th Division instructed the Kamawara Brigade to press hard on the district running along the railway line. Taking possession of the aerodrome at Kahang at 7 p.m. on the 25th, General Matsu's main force detoured to the south from the east to seize Kahang at midnight the same day. Singora Brigade hotly pursued the enemy from the main range sector and seized Ayer Hitam at the same time. Repairing the bridge that had been thoroughly destroyed by the enemy and acting in concert with the Kawamara Brigade in routing resistance from the road, they brought the front line to Rengham within hailing distance of the pivotal point of Kalang. So let's have a look at that's just disaster. There's all these lines of Japanese just coming down to Singapore. There's a map here on page 173. Breaking through several fortified lines of enemy's positions to the south of Rengham, the 5th Division took Liang Lang on the 28th and Senak area the morning of the 31st, capturing and disarming approximately 1,500 enemy troops of the 22nd Brigade of the 9th Indian Division, who, after being defeated, escaped into the neighbouring jungle. Poor Indians, I wonder what happened to them. At 3:30 on the afternoon, the 31st, the leading troops of the division charged into Johor Bahru, which is Johor Bahru's opposite Singapore. Sickening. At the outset, the Kanu Imperial Guard Division had considered making a raid on the 5th Division front to intercept the retreat of the main enemy force, but during the fighting in the vicinity of Bakri Parutsong, the 5th Division single-handedly broke through the enemy lines around Kalang and continued southward advance. Altering our original schedule, which were one-hour sections of our forces, opposed the enemy at the Yongpien area, our main strength attacked them from Batu Parat. The assault battalion, which had landed in the enemy rear from small boats between Batu Parat and Serang, was putting up a strenuous fight in an unsupported siege by sending the Kanush pursuit unit further down the coast to Serang. Attacking there, we rescued the assault battalion and threw the enemy into confusion, which Bashful's description. He's going to describe it, I think. Raking up all our forces in the area, we repeated our attacks for roughly about a week. And finally, the enemy, after they had nearly crushed our assault battalion, at last met their fate, the collapse of all their forces in the districts. British troops withdrew to the neighbourhood of Rengit. Some managed to rejoin the main British force overland, but the majority, comprising about 2,000 men, were evacuated by the Royal Navy on four successive nights. Making Mesang their right wing and evacuate Kalang, the enemy retired to their last line of resistance across the Johor River, which they were promptly driven out by a rapid pursuit by both Kanu and 5th Division. This troop, after landing at Singora, had broken through the Jitra line and captured Alor Star and maintained the progress of the operations according to the schedule right to the day. They had indeed hit the nail right on the head splendidly. Oh, sorry, that just makes me sick. The troops were not exhausted. The unit with the best cars rushed into Johor Bahru, where remnants of the enemy were still appearing and disappearing. And then suddenly, look, On the high ground on the Sultan's Palace, a Japanese flag was fluttering spiritedly in the sea breeze. Did it not command a bird's-eye view of Singapore? Since landing in southern Thailand barely 55 days ago, we had made an overland dash of 1,100 kilometres, exactly comparable to the distance from Tokyo to Shimotsu, half the length of Honshu, a principal island of Japan. We had fought 95 large and small engagements and repaired more than 250 bridges. The speed of the assault was unparalleled in the history of war. On the average, our troops had fought 2 battles, repaired 4 and 5 bridges, and advanced 20 kilometres every day. Our small boats without armaments had manoeuvred and carried out landings up to 650 kilometres behind the enemy lines on the west coast, and even surpassed the achievements of the troops on land. Singapore, the British stronghold which had for over 100 years dominated Asia, now lay before our eyes, pouring the ground on its last moments. Those who had braved the sea's passage, landed in southern Thailand, crept through the most impenetrable jungle, destroyed the stubborn enemy, and achieved an apparently impossible by bringing the Malayan campaign to a successful conclusion, where the front line officers and men in Malaya was a gift resulting from their strenuous efforts. The fight for Singapore was now on. The first-class modern fortress, flaunting its impregnability, appeared undaunted before our tired eyes. Johor State was over 1,500 metres wide at high tide. The Salad Naval Base protected from the left front. The enemy fighter planes were continuously patrolling over the straits. From various places, the rubber jungle rose columns of dense black smoke. The enemy had nearly 1,000 guns, large and small, all unlimited ammunition supply, all awaiting our attack. The anti-aircraft guns held the airplanes in check with dense barrage. We knew, however, the rear of the fortress defences were weakest, and we had to exhaust every means in our power, whether it was a plan of the gods or plan of the devils, to reduce the great fortress by the 11th of February, the anniversary of the coronation of Emperor Jimmu Tenno. On the high ground of the Sultan's Palace, a map was drawn up, giving full details of the fortress as observed. After thoroughly investigating the deployment of our heavy siege guns, the preparation for attack of our divisions, the enemy defence positions to the foreshores, fresh plans, the final attack materialised, everyone acknowledged the necessity of modifying the original plan. Returning to Kalan headquarters that evening, the staff worked all night on the final plans of assault on the fortress. Our staff officers, Aseda, who's that fantastic ninja, one who went down to Thailand to do his own investigation, and Kunitek assisted very ably. All staff officers in the rear were impressed with the necessity of accumulating the full quota of ammunition supplies laid down, namely 1,000 rounds for field guns, 500 rounds for heavy guns. Intelligence was asked for its appreciation of the strength of the enemy, who had recently received reinforcements from England and Australia. From Tokyo, Tominga, head of the personnel bureau, and Tanaka, chief of operations sections, visited army headquarters. Senior officers' discussions continued throughout the night. The material results of the Malayan campaign, from the landing of Singora to the time of arrival of our troops on Johor Strait, were as follows. 1. The Japanese forces, numbering approximately 35,000 men against the British of 80,000, destroyed 5 brigades of roughly 25,000 men. Booty captured comprised of 13 airplanes, roughly 330 grain guns, roughly 550 light and heavy machine guns, and about 50 tanks and armed tanks. Evidently, Bren gun carriers, the British forces had no tanks and armoured cars, about 360 motor vehicles and 800 locomotives and railway tracks. The Japanese losses were 1,700 men killed in battle, 2,700 wounded, and a total of 4,500 casualties. Quite unexpectedly, the sickness rate was very low. In particular, there was scarcely any sufferers from malaria. The spirit of the troops remained high throughout the campaign. Operations progressed normally without excessive driving of the troops. Rigorous military discipline was maintained except for the occasional rape, I would note. Reasons for all this was probably the brief periods of rest and recuperation given to all troops after completion of their tours of duty on the front line. Great victories are not expressed in figures. Two important factors to winning them are expressed in phrases. Quote, troops laboured for hours, quote, and, quote, They were firmly confident of certain victory when in conflict. Mr. Churchill, in his memoirs, criticises our military operations thus, quote, "Before the Great European War of 1914-18, there was a thorough investigation by Japan of the conditions and the welfare of Malaya, and the large-scale plan of invasion was exhaustively prepared," end quote. If such had been the case, our task would have been much easier. In the Malayan campaign, 1941-42, there was in fact very few of our officers or men experienced in Malayan conditions. In the whole army, they could be counted on the fingers of one hand. I myself had spent nearly an hour making an aerial reconnaissance over northern Malaya from southern Thailand. If, as Mr. Churchill states, the preparation for the campaign had been carried out exhaustively over a long period, I firmly believe we would have shortened it by at least a month. Time taken for assault. General Mishita, while travelling in Germany, had discussions with Marshal Goering and officers of the German military technical schools, and they had told him that in the event of war, the Far East and reduction of Singapore would probably take nearly a year and a half with five divisions. Well, what was the Germans? What would Goering know? They made a few misestimates there. Okay, we're into part six, and it's important that I do read through for my rehabilitation. Sorry, guys, if you're listening. So part six, Singapore, chapter 44. It's, I think, episode 28 I'm going through. But here, chapter 44, page 177, Singapore, the pivot. Singapore was Britain's pivotal point of domination of Asia. It was the first eastern gate for the defence of India and the northern gate for the defence of Australia, definitely. It was the axis of the steamship route from Europe to the Orient, north to Hong Kong and Shanghai, and so the treasures of the just each Indies to the south and east. Through these two arteries alone, during a period of many years, Britain controlled the Pacific Oceans with Singapore at the very heart of the area. The young spirited empire builder, Sir Stamford Raffles, controlling a few troops, landed on the territory and hoisted the Union Jack in January 1819. On February 6th, by skillful diplomatic measures, he pacified Lamont, the Mohammedan king of Johor, who barely $650,000, thus acquiring a perpetual lease. He then set to work to establish a commercial port. Singapore at the time, a village with a savage jungle, with nothing more than a barbarian village scattered there, here and there. Then by 1824, the whole island was formally transferred to the British East India Company. In 1923, 2 years after the Washington Conference had solved the problem of the abolition of the Anglo-Japanese alliance, Britain commenced strengthening the defences of the island, and Washington Agreement restricted the expansion of the Japanese Navy. Of course, this entire Washington Agreement, the Americans adhered to it, everyone else adhered to it, the Japanese didn't, and so they had a massive navy. But permitting Britain to proceed with a plan for the fortification of Singapore at an enormous cost of many millions of pounds sterling to protect the completed over 10 years, while at the same time, this is really a Martian alarm, while at the same time, defence measures on the other countries selectively restricted. In 1938, with the completion of the large floating dock and the King George the VI graving dock, Singapore became the first-class modern fortress, one of the four great fortresses in the world, ranking with Gibraltar, Pearl Harbor, and Malta. I wouldn't know. Is Pearl Harbor a fortress? It was already in use, and the British went so far as to boast its magnificent power. With the outbreak of the China incident in 1937, the policies of Britain and Japan came sharply pitted against each other in the Eastern Asia. British established her East Asia Army headquarters in Singapore under the supreme command of General Purnell, planned the unification of local volunteer forces and consolidated defences with Australian and Indian soldiers. Then, with the assistance of America, she enforced a military position in epoch-making fashion just prior to the outbreak of hostilities, when the Japanese-American conference was at the peak and the tensions at its highest. Britain supposed that Singapore was an impregnable fortress, and her attempt to coercion of Japan by dispatching to Singapore the two great battleships Repulse and Prince of Wales were things that remain fresh even now in the memory of the people of Japan. Singapore was naturally easy to defend. with the consolidation of equipment, it could be shaped into an impregnable fortress. Facing the seacoast, a battery of 15-inch guns was installed, which dominated the eastern mouth of the Johor Strait and protected the vast military barracks of Changi. Oh, God. The fortress was constructed out of steel and concrete, with the world's greatest guns directed their forbidding muscles towards the seafront. The military airfields of Tang, Kelang, Sitar and Semwak were good bases for operations for a large air force, and in the Setal naval harbour, aforementioned docks were installed that could be easily take 50,000 tons of battleships. The British boasted about 5 graving docks, the King George VI, which is 1,000 feet long, 1,130 feet wide, and about 90,000 cubic yards of cement were used in its constructions. The floating docks, little if any inferior in capacity, was constructed in England and towed to Singapore in 2 separate pieces. It had an overall length of 1,000 feet and an overall width of 300 feet, and was anchored in the mooring place at 70 feet in depth, about 1.5 million tons of fuel and oil, sufficient to maintain the whole of the British fleet to provide an emergency, was stored in a number of large storage tanks. The fortress took nearly 10 years to build, cost over £10 million sterling, and was completed in February 38. At the opening ceremony, the great naval ports, a threatening attitude towards Japan's southwards advance was revealed by the attendance of the battleships from every nation of the British and American Allied camp. In the spring of 37, a plan to equip completely and consolidate the fleets of both hemispheres was introduced to British Parliament. But as this work was not yet completed, it was in the case of having the chicken house ready but no chickens. In this great force, that's a quote, in this great fortress, which British and Britain boasted would never be captured by attack by sea, there was, however, an important weakness. As already stated, the rear defences of the region of the Johor province were incomplete. This resulted from a defect in the organisation of the fortress, or rather from a defect of the plan of military operations. In other words, to the land in southern Thailand and brave the intense heat and long distance of 1,100 kilometres in advance through dense jungle was probably deemed impossibility. By what seemed to the British common sense judgment, a Japanese army contemplating such operations in emergency would, it appeared, in view of the long distance overland, have to labour for perhaps more than a year to reach Singapore from Thailand. In the meantime, it was not difficult to imagine that the British would complete fortifications of the land would fort. In barely 55 days, however, the Japanese army overwhelmed Malaya, carrying everything before it, and during the campaign, the British, not being gods, were never certain of our whereabouts. According to Mr. Churchill's memoir, Singapore rear defences, Johor front, were believed to be in readiness. This was accepted by everyone as a matter of course. On the morning of the 19th of January, a telephone from General Wavell to Mr. Churchill for the first time heard that not only there was no permanent fortifications of the rear defence force in Singapore, but also since the outbreak of hostilities, especially since the Japanese had been building up strength in the southern part of Indochina, the lack of rear fortifications had not even been considered or discussed by any commanding officer in Singapore. The suggestion had not even made the field operation fortifications should be constructed. It seems inconceivable that the British in Singapore should neglect to report the truth of the non-existence of rear defences. In circumstances, Churchill's rebuke was quite proper. Among commanding officers in the Malayan theatre, there was not one who had the tithe of choosing enthusiasm and feeling of responsibility of Mr. Churchill. This, however, was considered the unexpected good fortune of the Japanese army. Now, I should mention that this is exactly the same sort of case here. There are things which are not right, and it's just this political thing of just not, you know, there are basic things which you're not satisfied with, which are very obvious, but the overall command structure just does not let you to put it forward, but you have to keep on going forward. And this is 19 minutes in. The next one will be the plan for capture, chapter 45, page 180. And we're getting towards the end. And there's a few things here. And of course, this sort of mentioning that the Changi was a British barracks is a pretty amazing thing. Look, thanks a lot. And I'll continue working on this. podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.